Okay, this is Ed Addio. This is August the 25th, 2015. We're in the conference room at the Mill Valley Library, and I'm speaking with Don Hunter, a retired city manager of the city of Mill Valley. And Don, we'll start with, let's go as far back as you know about your ancestry.
Okay. I know from another relative that we can trace ourselves all the way to Scotland. But when we get to the United States, we lose a few generations. So what I really have any significant information on is just my grandparents on both sides of the family. On my mother's side, I know less because we just spend less time with them. They were in Southern California. That's where Mom was born and raised. Her mother was Ruth Ewing, and her father was Robert Ewing.
What part of Southern California?
Covina.
Covina.
Yeah. And they moved around, but they were in Anaheim a little bit, but Covina is where they spent most of the time when they were being raised. And her father was a big thinker, always going to have the next big thing, but it never really panned out too well. Her mother was a jewelry maker. That's one of the things I do remember is later in life she moved to San Jose, and when I was going to San Jose State, my grandmother lived about five blocks from me. So I'd go down and have dinner with her occasionally, and I'd get to see her making jewelry. She did cloisonne and those sort of things. Then on my father's side, his mother, my grandmother, was Ethel Clark, and then she became Ethel Hunter, and she was a school principal and best cook I've ever been around in my life. Mm. She was a traditional grandmother with the pies on the windowsill when you came to visit. My grandfather, Roy, was a general contractor who, during the Depression, went to work for the Watsonville School District as a custodian, ended up being head of custodial services for the school district.
They lived in Watsonville?
Lived in Watsonville, and we saw a lot of them. That was the family growing up, was we'd go and visit them and Dad's sister who lived there and her husband. So that was the family we were closest to. We have on tape Grandma Hunter telling about going to Yosemite in a covered wagon.
Wow.
She told great stories and lived a great life, I think. She died at 98 in the Odd Fellows home in Los Gatos. And for a woman who was almost 300 pounds,
wow,
she was very active to the end. So those were good memories. I wish we'd been closer to the other side of the family, but it didn't happen. Then I have a sister who's 2 years older than me. She lives in Novato.
What's her name?
Gail. And Gail is, at this point, she's working for PricewaterhouseCoopers, right? That's right. As an office manager in San Francisco, so we're close to her, too. So most of the family stayed in the area. My parents lived in Mill Valley while we were growing up and retired to Napa.
So you were born in Watsonville?
I was actually born in San Jose, but yeah, my parents at that point had moved to Los Gatos.
Oh, okay.
And I was in Los Gatos until I was like 3 years old, and then we moved to Mill Valley. Dad was with B of A, and at that point, you know, you could only pass up so many transfers or else you stopped getting promoted. So he took the transfer to Mill Valley, and that's how we got here.
You once told me the story about during the war or before the war or after the war, your father had an opportunity to join the startup outfit?
After the war, I think what we were talking about is the fact that both of my parents were Depression kids. They were raised during the Depression. And my mother in particular, because of her father's penchant for always chasing the dream, had a tough time during the Depression. They were on the street some. So Dad got a job with B of A, and it was a good job, and he was paid every 2 weeks, and so he got an old college roommate of his asked him if he was interested in coming to work for a new company that these guys were starting up. They needed a chief financial officer, and my mother just said no, that, you know, you're not giving up that paycheck. We need that paycheck every 2 weeks, and so Dad didn't go to work for Hewlett-Packard.
I love that story.
It's the truth. Yeah, it's
two guys in a garage.
Two guys in a garage, and his buddy was their operating officer. His old college buddy was their first operating officer. He was one of their first employees and worked for them until he retired.
Wow.
And did very well.
Yes.
So
the janitor did very well.
Yeah. It's always been something that you know my mother laughs about, but you know Dad doesn't laugh all the time, or didn't.
Yeah.
Both my parents have passed away. But
so he had a career with Bank of America.
Yeah, 40 years, and I think I mentioned to you that that was back in the days when B of A, like most employers, really took care of people. They counted his years in the service as years with the bank for retirement purposes.
Oh.
And you know, they held his job, and he'd only been with them a little over a year before he was drafted into the service. But they saved the job, they counted it towards retirement, and that was back in the day where APG&E was still running Bank of America.
Yeah.
And it was really a family-oriented business.
Did your father see any action in World War II?
My father did. He was in the Pacific Theater, and he landed on Iwo Jima.
Oh, wow.
And he was Army, not Marine, so he wasn't the first wave in. But they were still being shelled on the beaches when he came in. It was very interesting. He didn't talk about that much until much later in life. I'm not sure if it just was memories he didn't want to dredge up, but we all kind of pushed him a little bit towards the end of his life, and he told the whole stories and everything. He was a staff sergeant, and he was mainly clerical, he carried a gun and all that stuff, but he was mainly clerical for the commander. And he told one great story where the commander said, "Sergeant, I want you to get a Jeep. We're going up to the top of the hill and see what's going on." They got in the Jeep. Dad drove them to the top of the hill, and they were just being shelled right and left, and the commander said, "I think we ought to go down now." But it was interesting. That was he spent all of the war in the Pacific, but that was the most exciting thing.
That's great. A lot of those World War II heroes didn't talk about it for years and years and years.
Yeah, he still tells or told before he passed away. He told of not really wanting to get to know people because you were going to lose them.
Yeah, friends.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay, so you moved to Mill Valley when you were three.
Correct.
And where did you live?
I lived on the corner of Nelson and East Blythedale, 118 Nelson Avenue, right across from Kite Hill. And that was back in the day where you could get the neighborhood boys together and race boats in the gutters of Blythedale, because there just wasn't much traffic.
Yeah, and climb up on Kite Hill.
Kite Hill and cardboard slide, and when we got more advanced, we built sleds and used paraffin on the runners to get them to go good down the hill. And it was big fun. Great place to be a kid.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So did you go to, what local school would you go to then?
Well, I should have gone to Park, but because of districting and number of kids and everything, I started at Alto.
Alto,
which is now a private school, but it's leased by the school district too. I don't know what the name of it is, but it's over there next to Edna McGuire. The next building over was Alto School.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
And I did that for 1 year, and then they redistrict again, and I finished at Park. I went back to Park, and I went there through sixth grade, because back then it was K-6. And then I went to Edna McGuire, which was then the junior high, 7-8. And then I went on to TAM. Park School was a great place to go to school. I mean, first of all, you could walk straight down Blythedale and be there in 10 minutes from my house. And I was probably one of the furthest away from school.
Mm.
And they had this great softball diamond under the big trees is that Elm Avenue right there? By the stoplight? I think that's Elm going down.
Elm, yeah.
Yeah. And we would go out there and we would play these softball games, play workout. Get somebody out, all the positions move up one, and then when you get to hit, you get to bat until you make an out. I just remember that being...
Was that sand and grass?
No,
asphalt?
It was asphalt. Everything, I don't think, until you got to junior high, any of the elementary schools had, had anything but asphalt at that time. But they, there was a Bill Castelli was a fifth grade teacher there. It was probably my first experience with a male teacher.
Castelli,
C-A-S. And he was just great. I mean, he'd go out, he'd organize these ball games. If he needed to, he'd pitch. He was wonderful.
And
so then when I went to Edna McGuire, by this point, my mother had gone back to work, and she was teaching at Edna McGuire. She was teaching women's PE. She ended her career at Homestead as a fifth grade teacher. But she tells the story, it's not all that different than now. We read about the teacher shortage every place now that's going on. Well, back then there was too. She was hired at a cocktail party where the superintendent of school had heard she was a teacher. He came over and chatted for a while and then offered her a job at the party.
Wow.
Just to, because they needed bodies. And she was a certificated teacher. And so it wasn't the greatest thing in the world having your mom, especially in junior high when you're in seventh and eighth grade. And
yeah.
You know, you're discovering girls for the first time and your mom's the girls' PE teacher. It worked, but it wasn't the best thing I ever did in my life. But it was, that was what we did back then. Everybody went to the same, all the schools fed into the junior high. And so that's where you started meeting people from around town. Your circle of friends expanded.
Mm-hmm.
And then went on to Tam High from there. When I was in at Park and at Alto, that's when I started playing Little League ball. 1958, I think, was the first year they opened Boyle Park for Little League. Because prior to that, it had been a semi-pro field.
And yeah, that's what I've heard.
Yeah, and Mill Valley Merchants was the name of the team. And they got big-name people to play there. DiMaggio played there.
No kidding.
Yeah, way back when. Yeah. Not long before my time, but way back when he played there. And the one diamond was down by what's now the tennis club.
Yeah.
And it fanned out coming back towards Blythedale. They played some good games there.
That's
the
cool.
Merchants moved to Project 17 afterwards.
Where's that?
Project 17 is what's now the middle school.
Oh,
and
yeah.
The community center. It's 17 because it was 17 acres. And that was a hoot. Because by then, I was old enough to go watch and to try and make money because of all the marsh around there, they'd pay you a dime if you could catch a foul ball before it got to the water.
Oh, really?
So the kids would be all down there with their gloves trying to make some money. But it was a hoot because it settled so badly there. They didn't have any, you know, they didn't do the things they do now to compact the soil. So that you could see a guy leaving left field heading towards center, and by the time you got to center, you could only see the top half of his body because he's down in this big hollow. It was, but that was fun. And then when we played Little League at Boyle, everybody moved there. That was, there were still the two leagues. Then it was National and American, but National was all kids within the city limits. American was all the kids in the unincorporated areas. So Homestead, Tam Valley, those were all in the American League, and they just did it by addresses.
That's right. They played across from the closest one would be the National League, and the other one near the tennis club was the American League.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And everybody played in the same place. There wasn't a minor league field, a major league field. You know, certain nights were major league, certain nights were minor league, and that's all there was. There wasn't anything less than minor league. There were just the two leagues playing. And if I recall correctly, there couldn't have been more than six teams in any league. It just wasn't that big.
No, there weren't. Because I coached and managed there for about 15 years. And then I remember the T-ball that the Pee Wee Leagues were over where what is now Hockey Park.
Yeah,
Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah.
That was after my time. They didn't have those when I played.
Right.
But growing, as I grew up, they started that over there. And then my first experience with Little League was the year before they opened, Boyle, and we played out at Alto School, and it was all dirt with a lot of rock. You could be right squared up on a grounder, and it'd go right over your shoulder because it hit a rock. You're lucky if it didn't hit you.
Yeah.
So Boyle was a big thing when they opened that for us.
Yeah.
So that takes me through junior high. There was one teacher at junior high that I just love. Martha Robinson taught social studies in English. And I'll never forget, she always had this thing about fresh air in the classroom and stuff. She would, if it's stuffy or the windows are closed, she would call someone by name and say, "Would you be so kind and condescending as to stoop so low without bending as to open a window?" She was, and she was great. She would give, we had to build the Globe Theater. And that's pretty intricate. You know, it's not easy. You've got dowels and all these things. And two or three kids, they brought these things in and you looked at it. How'd they do that? Well, their parents did it, is how they did it, of course.
Oh, yeah.
And mine was barely standing up. And I still remember I got an A, because she knows I did it myself, even though it was kind of going like this.
Yeah, yeah.
But she was a great teacher.
Good.
Yeah. Then I went on to TAM. Started there in 63. And one of the first memories was JFK being shot.
Oh.
When yeah. I was a freshman. That was probably, looking back on it, was probably when I kind of woke up to the world outside of Mill Valley.
That's right. Now, you were in school then at the time.
Yeah, it was in November, wasn't it? It was November, if I'm recalling correctly.
I recall I got a phone call from my wife at work, and it was about 9:30 in the morning when we heard.
I know it was morning. I don't know what time.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they, you know, they came on the loudspeakers, and they let us out of class, and we could wander around campus and talk. We didn't go home, but, you know, they just stopped teaching. And it really was like Camelot's over. You know, it was just a dose of reality. And some kids, you know, I mean, I was not actively involved in politics at the time, but a lot of the kids that were just devastated. And at that point, you know, we all started paying attention more. And maybe it was just because I was a freshman in high school and it was time anyhow. Mm. But that was pretty impressive. And then in the 4 years I was there, the music scene in the area blew up. You know, we had Sopwith Camel here. We had Jefferson Airplane here. We had Grateful Dead here. All of them, you know, in Marin, but also in Haight-Ashbury. You know, we had a local group called Clover.
Yeah, it was about 1965 when the Flower Children came in.
Yeah, 65, 66, and then the Summer of Love was 67, the year I graduated.
That's right.
Yeah. And I have to admit, I spent a little time in Haight-Ashbury then, soaking up the scene. I was more of an onlooker. I was just flabbergasted at the clothes and the hair and the whole, it was just a scene. Lots of local music too. Alex Call had this band club Clover, and they had this kid that I played Pony League with that played harmonica for him, a kid named Hugh Gregg, who was Huey Lewis Gregg.
Oh.
And so Huey got his start with Clover. And so all of that was going on. And it was pretty interesting to be around and watch it all go, because you know, you've got that, and then at the same time, my senior yearbook was dedicated to the first guy from TAM to die in Vietnam.
Oh.
He left school after his junior year. He was our age, and he died that year. So Vietnam was on us, and that made you pay attention to world politics, because it was going to affect you. It was going to be about, you know, are you going to Vietnam? And I spent a lot of time thinking and talking with my dad.
Worried about the draft?
Worried about what I'd do if I was drafted. Jack Bartlett was our minister at the time and is still a good friend. And I talked to Jack a lot about it. You know, was I a conscientious objector? Wasn't really, I don't think, but I certainly felt the war in Vietnam was wrong. And then I hit the lottery, literally. I was
the lottery?
The lottery. I went to college, so I had my student deferment. And my sophomore year in college, they held the first draft lottery. They actually pulled numbers, birthday dates by numbers. Number one was September, whatever it was, and all the way through 365. And then they drafted by those numbers to get your draft cap. I was draft number 197. And at the end of, so that was the next year, at the end of my junior year of college, I got a letter from my draft board saying that I had been transferred from 2S student deferment to 1A. And I just, what? I've got another year here. And I called the draft board, and this wonderfully nice lady said, yes, we have made our final call for this year. And we called through number 196.
Oh.
Everything higher than 196, we're putting in the 1A pool so that come December 31st, New Year's this year, you are out of the draft unless we go through all 365 next year. And, of course, they weren't going to do that. That was every eligible person. And so I didn't want to be rude, but I said, you wouldn't mind putting that in writing, would you? And she did. And that was my best New Year's Eve ever.
Wow.
So I never really had to face the decision. And I did get the deferment, but I lost friends in Vietnam. That was my generation that was there.
Yeah.
And I had friends who came back who weren't the same. And I think everyone can tell you the same stories.
Yeah.
So that was probably the most defining thing of the era for us.
Yeah.
But high school, before I leave it, other than the specific instance that kind of make you look at the bigger world, was a heck of a fun time at Tam High. It was a meld of Sausalito, Mill Valley, the Beach Kids, which were a breed unto themselves that came over the hill.
That's right.
Marin City, and then we got all the military brats from Fort Baker.
Oh, yeah.
So we had all sorts of people there, and for the most part, got along really well. But the real first hippies were the Beach Kids. You know, those were the ones that were the precursor to the summer of love. They were all long hair and how fast can I get out of here and get surfing, it was interesting. But we had, it was the whole experience. You had the junior prom, the senior ball, the Sadie Hawkins Day dances, all the old stuff that I'm not even sure they still do anymore.
Yeah.
And everybody played sports.
I hear you had from what I've heard over the past couple of years, there was a pretty dedicated group of teachers there too.
There was a great group of teachers. I think it speaks volumes to the principals and the administration, but also to the fact that you had an engaged student body, because teachers came there and they stayed. You know, you didn't have a lot of turnover. My favorite was Robert Sherman, an English teacher. I mean, he was just a great, great man in terms of his teaching ability. He cared about every student he had. But, you can go through Dwayne Smith and all of them there, even George Gustafson, who by the time I was there must have been 70, teaching PE, they were always checking in with you, are you okay? Are you going to come out for this team? Are you going to do that? They were always, I was really into journalism in high school, and I wrote for the Tam High News. I was a sports editor when I was a junior, and I was editor-in-chief when I was senior.
Oh, wow.
And so we had a young, exciting journalism teacher who was probably the first African-American teacher I'd ever had. Her name was Martha Myricks. And she just made you get excited about it. And she did things like when I was on the news staff and she had a freshman writing class, she'd have me chase somebody else from the staff through the room, jump out the window in the back, and keep running. And then she'd make the kids write about what they just saw. I mean, she was a pretty fun person to have as a teacher.
Yeah.
So she got me very, very pumped up about it. And, I started writing sports because I love sports. And then the more and more I wrote, I kind of went into the overall news thing. And that's what I started out in college, as a journalism major. But she was great. They were just the Hells Bells Hawkins was a math teacher back in the day when he could still
Hells Bells Hawkins.
His I don't even know what his first name was. It was Mr. Hawkins. We all called him Hells Bells Hawkins because when he'd get mad, he'd say Hells Bells.
Oh,
and he also Ernie Bergman, who is still around, is a wonderful friend, but he had a tendency to talk in class. And so Mr. Hawkins would bounce erasers off and just turn around at the board and whoop. And you could do that back then.
Yeah.
So he was. I mean, most of the teachers I had, the only teacher, it's too bad, he's a wonderful person and very popular here at the library, but the only teacher I had that wasn't as good as I'd hoped was Henry Bousset, he's actually got a piece in the oral history room. And because he was an art teacher, he was a great art teacher, but because he spoke French, they made him teach French. And he just wasn't that good as a French teacher. He was a great art teacher.
Right.
But other than that, I can't.
Henry Bousset?
Yeah.
How do you spell that?
Bousset, I think.
Okay. I can look it up.
Yeah. But other than that, I really can't think of a bad teacher I had. Of course, you know, Willie Hector was in the PE department. He had just come off of a pro football career, so everybody loved hanging around with him.
It was
a great time. You know, I ran cross country, I played baseball, I played basketball, gave up baseball after my sophomore year and ran track. But, you know, you had a constant group of friends. You know, as soon as school was out, you were on the field with somebody. You know, and it was in a day when, you know, when the football game was Friday night, the whole school went. I mean, you filled the stands. Mm. And that doesn't happen anymore either. You know,
yeah.
And the basketball games would sell out. You know, it was what there was to do.
Yeah.
It was fun.
So let's go to college now. You went to San Jose State.
I did.
As a journalism major.
Yeah, because at that point, it had a great reputation as a journalism school. Actually, still remember Dwight Bentel was the dean of the school, and he was quite well thought of. And after about a year, I figured out there's no money in it.
You know, in journalism.
In journalism. I'm not, you know, unless you're that, you know, top small percentage that are writing books or columns or something, you know, there's not much money in it. Working for the Mill Valley Record or the Mill Valley Herald or, you know, it's just, so I changed my major and I went into public administration / parks and recreation. And
That went well with your love of sports.
Well, exactly. It went well with the love of sports. And I'd been working for the Parks and Recreation Department in Mill Valley since I was a sophomore in high school, doing summer day camps and stuff. And I knew that what the work was. I found out after I changed my major that there's lots of things you can do in that. There's a therapeutic recreation. There's geriatric recreation. There's commercial recreation. I mean, everybody who's manning, who's running Disneyland and Six Flags and all of those people, that's their background. But I went into municipal recreation because I like the sports. I wanted to stay with, you know, running sports leagues and putting on events and taking trips and doing all of those things. So that's how I got started. I ruined it. I mean, I had a good thing going. I got out in 4 years. Nobody does that. You know, I went through college in 4 years. I could have stretched it to six, like they most of them do now. Went right to work. You know, and that's what you did back then.
And your first job was?
My first full-time job was with the city of Ferguson, Missouri, which is in the news a little bit.
In the news.
Ferguson is a suburb of St. Louis. So at that point, St. Louis was surrounded by 99. Incorporated cities, some as small as 400 people, some like Ferguson up in the 22,000-23,000 range. I think the biggest one was 40-some thousand. At the time that I was there, Ferguson was primarily a middle-class white community. But it was next to, you know, a primarily African-American community, Kinloch. And
what's the name of it?
Kinloch, K-I-N-L-O-C-K. And we had a big dust up there because one of our parks was right on the border, and city council or the mayor, I guess it was, I think it was just the mayor, wanted the basketball hoops taken out because the kids from Kinloch were coming over to play.
Oh, he didn't want the black kids playing on the white
kids playing on the white courts.
Wow.
And my boss, who was a California kid like me, refused. And he got in all sorts of trouble and was out of a job for a little bit before the calmer heads of the attorneys prevailed.
Right. So even back then, there was some tension going on?
There was tension. There was I have to tell you, you know, when I was in St. Louis, and that was my one year, literally day to day 1 year, I was in St. Louis. But it was my first experience outside of California. And having gone to Tam High with, you know, a bunch of black kids, some from Marin City, some from Fort Baker, military kids, it never dawned on me that there was going to be this type of separation of races that I saw back in early 70s St. Louis. It was pretty stark and surprising. And on my first wrong turn into East St. Louis was an interesting experience. There really was some bad unemployment in ghettos in St. Louis proper. So that was interesting for me. It was another one of those life experiences. At probably the highlight of my time in Missouri, I was learning to play ice hockey.
Ice hockey?
Yeah. Look, our parks department was in charge of the ponds. They'd freeze, and we'd put out garbage cans and fires and stuff, and we'd have staff there in the evenings. Susan and I would go down, skate arm in arm in the frozen ponds in the winter. It was great fun. We both learned to skate while we were there.
That's right. They had real winter times.
Real winter times, yes. Snow. And so we had a department hockey team that played in one of our own leagues. And they put me on the team and let me play. And they even set me up to score one goal. And they said, don't come down at this end. You just wait here. And they will come down. And they cleared out the goal and passed me the puck. And sure enough, I got it in the net. So that was a lot of fun, though. I loved.
That's great.
I loved winter, by the way. I hated summer.
In St. Louis.
Oh, hot, humid, and muggy.
I'll bet.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you mentioned Susan. She was with you in Ferguson.
Right.
So let's go back to when you met her. How did you meet Susan?
I met Susan at a wine tasting party in San Diego.
A wine tasting?
Yeah. It was part of the California Park and Recreation Society, the professional society for people in parks and recreation. Susan was a student. I had just graduated and was working part-time for the city of Mill Valley. And I was attending this, looking for my first full-time job. And
what was her name?
Susan Hamilton.
Hamilton.
And the local North Bay chapter of the Park and Recreation Society always held a wine tasting because Napa and all the other cities would go get donations and bring the wine down. And I met this beautiful girl there, and I couldn't stop thinking about her. I got her phone number and called her when we got home, and we started going out. And then
where did she live?
San Jose.
Oh.
When I was in Mill Valley at that time. We went out, and this was probably June when we met, and we went out for a little bit, and then she went to work for Camp Kanakdai at Kanakdai Harbor Inn on Clear Lake.
Oh, yeah.
And so, as I say, I was working part-time for the city of Mill Valley. I'd get off at 10, drive up to Clear Lake. By that time, she'd have her campers put down for the night, and we'd sit around and talk, I'd drive back at 2 in the morning, and she'd go back to her cabin. And when she finished camp there, that's when I got offered the job in Ferguson. And we decided to get married because we had heard and checked that it was correct that they enforced their laws of cohabitation in Missouri. They didn't want you living together if you weren't married.
So did you pop the question at Camp Kanakdai?
No, I popped the question by Alpine Lake. And she said yes. We got married in her parents' living room on 2 weeks' notice because I had to get back and take the job.
In San Jose?
In San Jose. And we had a reception at the local community center and took off the next day for Missouri.
Wow.
And we... It worked out good. It's not a bad thing to start your married life away from everybody's family.
But you never had a real honeymoon.
No, never did. Until later. We finally took her to Hawaii when we'd been married 3 years. We went to Hawaii for a week, and that was our real honeymoon.
Oh, good.
But yeah, so it was pretty quick, but it's worked. It's 43 years this November.
Long time.
Yeah.
Especially for people in Marin.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
So, okay, so a year in Ferguson, then you came back here.
I applied for a job with the city of Mill Valley that I had heard was open, and we drove out in our periwinkle blue AMC Gremlin.
Mm. What year was this?
73. And I interviewed, and we drove back. And I got a letter when we were not long after we got back offering me the job.
Did you start as Parks and Rec chairman?
I started as recreation supervisor, which was really one of only two positions at that point. There was the director and then the supervisor. So I started out as a supervisor, and I was a supervisor for about 9 months before the then director was having a little trouble getting along with the city manager. So he ended up going to the County of Marin.
Oh, that's right. What was his name?
Don Dimitratis.
That's right.
And he went to the County of Marin, and at that point, Ron Usher, who was the city manager, asked me into his office and asked me if I wanted the job, and I was very quick to say no. Too young. I can't run a whole department. Because I was 24. He said, "Do you know how much it pays?" And I said, "No." And he told me, and I said, "Okay, I'll take it." So I did.
What was the pay at that time?
$1,414 a month.
Wow. And you thought that was big time money, huh?
Well, when I graduated from college, I thought if I could ever make $10,000 a year, I was set.
I remember those days.
So yeah, it was big time money for me. I had people that I grew up with who were in the business world already making a lot more than that. But and then later on in life, I had guys that never even went to college who ended up being general contractors who made a lot more than that.
Yeah.
My
mother used to talk about five-figure men making $10,000 or more.
Yeah. Well, that was big. I mean, I thought I'd made it, so I took the job. And I learned on the job, and I had great help from wonderful, wonderful people in my profession and in the city. Still, my fondest memory was Bill Walsh, who was the police chief at that time.
Oh, yeah.
Bill, when we had our first big floods and stuff, he called me up and said, "Come on, we're going to go look." And he'd take me around, and he'd show me where the hot spots were. If you look there, if it's above that level, we've got trouble. If it doesn't reach that level, don't worry about it. And then he'd take you another place, and he'd drive around. He knew this city like the back of his hand. But he also knew the city council, because my first budget that I had to present to the city council, I had asked for not very much, but some money for teen programming, because I really wanted to get some night stuff going for the kids in town. And the council just was having none of it. So Bill Walsh stands up and he said, "Well, you can give Don the money now, or you can give it to me later." He said, "We don't give these kids something to do, they're going to end up being my problem."
Oh, yeah.
And they passed my budget. They gave me the money.
He was a good cop.
He was a very good cop.
He lived in Sutton Manor somewhere.
He did, which, by the way, was my second house. I lived at 118 Nelson until we were in junior high. And then we moved to 16 Somerset, directly across the street from Bill Walsh.
Oh.
So I knew Bill growing up when he was just a cop. Bill, I probably shouldn't tell this, get myself in trouble, but Bill chased me through the creeks in Boyle Park one night and didn't catch me.
That's funny.
We had, somebody came up with this great idea that we go down to the tennis courts at Boyle Park and wait, and there were probably 15 of us, and wait till a cop car goes by, then throw eggs at it.
Now, oh, no, my God.
I wasn't real bright. I said, "Sure, that sounds like, you know." So we do. And we didn't know that this guy who suggested it had done this 3 or 4 times before, so they were waiting for him. So as soon as the squad car, there's cop cars on every side of Boyle Park, and the lights go on, and all of us are just going. I went right down into the creek, and then I shot straight up the middle of the creek towards the tennis club. And then I went through that culvert down there, came up the other side and went straight up the hill and over the hill and down into Sutton Manor. And I thought, I'm great, I'm fine. And I jump in my bed. I'm asleep. Dad goes to the door, and Bill's there. And says, Charlie, is Don home?
Dad says, so he knew it was you.
Well, he knew all the people involved and that I was friends with all those people. He didn't know it was me for sure. Dad walks into the bedroom and says, yeah, sound asleep, Bill. Okay, thanks. And the next day, I go to breakfast and I've got all these scratches on my arms and everything. And Dad looks at me and says, have fun last night, Don?
Yeah, good.
No harm, no foul. But learned a lesson there too. Don't necessarily take somebody else's idea without doing a little research.
Yeah.
So, but Bill was just marvelous helping me learn. Tom Newton, the planning director, was good at helping me learn. And so, didn't take too long till I had it to the point where at least I understood the basics of the job and how to do it. It's not a lot different than any other job where you're working with a large organization. You've got to establish relationships with the other departments. You've got to be able to help them when they need it so that they'll help you when you need it. And you've got to be able to understand what it is the public wants.
Mm-hmm.
And that was always something that came relatively easy for me.
So some highlights of when you were chairman of Parks and Rec. I remember I was on the Parks and Rec Commission when we got the idea for the Bayfront Park
mm-hmm.
and the community center.
Mm-hmm.
And Jenny Fulley. So talk about those things.
Let's start with Jenny.
Little girl wanted to play Little League.
Yep.
I was chairman then.
Yep. And Little League, and I maybe I'm thinking too nicely of them, but Little League, I don't think it was so much that the local people didn't want Jenny to play, but they were going to lose their charter if they let her play. Little League, the national organization, wasn't about to budge on the issue. So they were kind of in a rock and a hard place. They were saying, no, she can't play. And I, if my memory serves correctly, wasn't Sam Loy president of Little League at that time?
Yes.
Yep.
Sam was.
And Sam was a nice guy. And I don't think he was discriminating. I think that he was trying to keep the league afloat. And so they were caught between a rock and a hard place. And Jenny ended up going to court.
I wrote a screenplay about that episode. And her mother was a single mom. She got calls. All the rednecks came out from the wood, under the woodwork. They got threats. Jenny was bullied at school. Eventually they went to court, Superior Court. Little League sent up psychiatrists from L.A. and all kinds of doctors explaining why girls couldn't play baseball because they weren't built right, things like that. Went to court, and the judge finally said, I read the transcripts. Judge finally said, either she plays Little League or I'm going to shut it down all over the country. And she got to play. It's quite a story, actually.
It is. And that whole doctors and psychiatrists stuff, I, to this day, remember in 1959, my Little League coach telling me he wished I could hit as well as my sister.
Really?
Oh, my sister was a hell of an athlete. Girls could play, especially at that level. Monet, what's her name, that just did the...
Oh, yeah, that little girl,
the little girl
back east.
From Chicago, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, clearly not only play, but pitch at the Little League level. I think it gets a little more difficult, although she's now pitching at 60 feet with a traveling team. I read an article in Sports Illustrated on that. So anything's possible. And the Pacific's just had a woman pitch.
Yes, that's right, just recently.
That was all bogus. That was just trying to keep the status quo. So that was interesting. That was a fun one. The Bayfront Park was interesting for two reasons. Number one, there was always the big controversy about, is there going to be an access road to the public safety building?
Yes, I remember that too.
Because the school district and the city traded lands for we got where the public safety building is. They got Project 17. And they built the middle school. So now you've got a major concentration of students. Plus, not long after that, because my father was on the board on the first board of the Redwoods when they opened. Now you had a major concentration of seniors that our fire department and police department had to go all the way out through Enchanted Knolls, around East Blythedale, back up Camino Alto to get to. And if you shot a straight road across, you could literally cut that time. You could take 70% off that travel time. And so everybody on the public safety side of the ledger wanted that road through. There were environmentalists and a number of other groups that didn't want the road to go through. And planning the Bayfront Park was delayed for a long time while they argued that out, and finally no road was built, as you know. And the master plan for the park was finally completed. And during my time with the city, the master plan was completed and adopted, and the park was completed. And that's saying something, because as much as I love my jobs with the city, things don't necessarily move fast in the city. Because you mentioned the community center. That was 15 years in the planning process.
Yes, I recall.
And from a staff perspective, it was done correctly. We put together a group of citizens, and I'm really high-powered people, nice group, and they really worked hard at it. But they ended up with a community center much grander than anything staff ever envisioned for the project. I'm sure you've heard the story that at one point in time they were even talking about putting a velodrome on the roof.
Yeah, I remember that.
And that, fortunately, that didn't get done. But, when we originally talked about it, there was no envisioning a pool. But the group worked. They had public hearings and invited ideas, and they worked. And then it took 15 years because we took a backseat to this, to the library expansion project, which came up. And we knew that the community center was going to use a lot less public financing and a lot more private fundraising. It was going to have to be a lengthy process to get the money in place, and this was a bond measure.
That finally happened when you were city manager, right?
It was opened when I was city manager. The building contracts were awarded while Doug Dawson was still here. It was under construction before I took over. But both the Bayfront Park and the community center are a testament to the tenaciousness of this community and to the fact that this community finds a way to get things done that a lot of towns don't. The amount of private donations, the amount of work and energy, and by donations, I don't mean just cash. We had a building committee of people that worked with, I was the staff liaison on it, but I had Jerry Cahill of Cahill Construction, I had Rich Robbins of Wareham Development, I had Gary Van Acker of Van Acker Construction, and Dennis Fisco of Seagate on my building committee. And so we'd hold regular meetings with them, and we'd invite the contractor in, and he would fill them in on what was going on, and I'd fill them in on my concerns. And this guy would try to run out his usual contractor, this is why I need a change order stuff, and these guys just kept him in line. They really knew their business, and they kept the cost of that building where it was supposed to be. And that it took a lot of time. A lot of time they donated to that project. By the same token, we have an organization called the Friends of the Fields here. We have top-notch athletic fields because of them. Those aren't city dollars out there. Those are private dollars that they raised and put into it. Mill Valley's blessed, not only with that, but great elected officials going all the way back as long as I can remember, from Bob Huber in the 50s all the way through Michael Warnham and Joseph Sheeks in the 60s to when I was there, Betsy Cutler and Kathleen Foote and Dick Spotswood and Dennis Fisco and
Ivan
Pudiat and Dick Jessup. You can go on forever. I mean, people serving for the right reason, not because they want to be assemblyman next.
Right.
But because, it's their time in the box to help guide their city. And then they step aside. Mill Valley has the unwritten two-term rule. which is unheard of in small towns. Yeah. A lot of times you get a mayor that's there for 32 years.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's when you get into trouble.
Yeah, true.
If you have the turnover, but I can only think of. Well, since the 50s. In the 50s, we had people over two terms. But since then, I can only think of one, and he was pretty much had his arm twisted to do a third turn.
I think the last third term was Spotswood.
Yeah, that's the one I'm thinking of.
Oh.
He got his arm twisted. I think people said, you can't leave. We need some continuity. And he did it. And I think he'll tell you that by the end of the third term, he was ready to go.
Yeah, yeah.
But so it's, when you do that, when you have that turnover, and when you do your job correctly as a city council, by that I mean you put good citizens on your commissions and you bring them up to understand the city, then you've got candidates to run the next time.
Yeah.
And you don't have candidates running on a single issue.
Yeah.
You know, I want my street paved.
So, okay, you're coming up through the ranks, and how did you come to be a city manager?
I came to be city manager primarily because of Doug Dawson. And Doug Dawson was the city manager. I worked for one, two, three.
He was after Vern Hazen.
After Vern Hazen, yeah. I worked for Ron Usher for a short period of time. Then Vern Hazen came in. Then Doug came in. Doug was in Corte Madera before he came over to Mill Valley. And Doug did two things really, really well. He did everything really well. He's the best city manager that I've ever met any place. Now, granted, he's a small town city manager, and that's what I love about my jobs, is I love being in small towns where you know most of the people and people can reach out and touch you. I'm sure that there are people that are trying to manage San Jose and places like that are probably technically better than Doug, but I'd be surprised. But one of the things that he did is he brought talent up from below. You know, if he saw something in you, he'd put you in a place that you could try to use that. And he came to me and asked me if I would be his assistant city manager / director of Parks and Recreation, still run the Parks and Recreation Department, but also be assistant city manager. And I thought about it, and it was perfect for me because I was ready to be looking for a bigger city or something, because we all want more challenge in life. You know, that's what keeps you going to work every morning. And so I could do that and not leave, not uproot my at that point, family. I had kids then. I said yes, despite the fact that it was my huge raise was the title. That's all I got. But it was wonderful. It was really good. By this time, when I first, I should step back 1 minute, because when I was first director of Parks and Recreation, it wasn't really Parks and Recreation. It was just Recreation. Parks was being run by Public Works. So I worked with Vern Hazen to bring the two back together, because my perspective was always that the parks were there to serve the people, and that it didn't matter if the green was perfect and if the shrubs were perfectly groomed, if you were shutting the park down and people couldn't use it to get it that way, or if you were turning on the water in the middle of the day when there were supposed to be events, and that happened on multiple occasions. So we got it back together, and at that point Public Works had it out to contract, and Cagwin Dorward was running it. Cagwin Dorward's a real good firm. They did a good job.
Cagwin and Dorward.
But they were more about green. They were more about the beauty of their product rather than the people using their product. And so we brought it back in-house, and we stole their supervisor, who was Rick Mizoraka, who's been in Mill Valley forever, just retired a couple years ago. And he and I had a great relationship, and he brought the parks to where they are, and he is the one who worked with Friends of the Fields to get all the fields done. He was just great. So I had Rick, and I knew that I didn't have to spend the kind of time in the parks that I had in the past. And I had, at that point, a woman by the name of Carly McCart.
Carly McCart.
Yeah, she's now the director of Parks and Recreation in San Rafael. But she was my recreation supervisor. So I had good people, so I knew I could take Doug's offer and just be an administrator at Parks and Recreation and learn the rest of the management business. And so I did, from Doug. And he had me be acting temporary department heads for other departments sometimes. He had me work with public safety and learn the issues of that end of the business, which is, I got to tell you, that's a stressful business. I would not want to be a police chief.
No.
So I did all of those things, and then I also compiled the city budget. And that's where you really learn what goes on. Because nothing goes on if it's not funded.
Yeah.
So I did that, worked with the finance director, and had meetings with all of the department heads, go over their requests. We'd trim it down, and we'd try to present something to Doug that, A, was within his guidelines, because there were some, you know, government, like everything else, goes through tough years and good years. And Mill Valley has, I have no idea what's going on now, but I assume it's still the same, that, you know, we have always insisted on having a solid reserve so that, you know, you have rainy day funds. And so you always had to keep that plentiful. And so I learned a lot. And then I also did labor relations with when I was the assistant city manager. So that's how I got into that. And then when Doug retired, and this is, he retired relatively young.
He did.
And I tell this story to people because I think it really explains it. I was kidding. Sometimes doing it in his office. Doug, what the heck's the matter with you? We had a deal. You were going to work until a year before I retired. Then I was just going to be city manager for a year, and then I was going to go out as city manager. How come you're going out so early? And he got all serious. He said, you know, when I started this business, I had a bucket full of patients. My bucket's empty, and I got to go. And I learned quickly that your bucket does empty in that job.
You got to understand what he meant.
Yeah. So, but then I became city manager after that.
What year was that?
98, I think.
98?
Yeah.
And you did it for how long?
8 years. Almost nine, 2007.
What are some of the highlight memories from when you were running the city?
Wow.
Couple of floods.
A couple of those aren't highlights. Those are lowlights.
Oh, that's right. Okay.
Highlights was I think seeing the community center open and being there for that.
Seeing the what?
The community center open.
Oh,
and being there for that. That was, I mean, I had spent so much of my professional career on that. To see it actually happen, and then to see it embraced by the community the way it is, and still is today, that's really a highlight. Also, being able to see Mill Valley get through the tech bubble burst and go through the budget problems we had and come out the other side. And I'd seen three or four different ones. I'd seen Prop 13. I'd seen the late 70s downturn. But the tech bubble was when I was city manager, and I had to go through the cutbacks with all the departments to see us come out the other side and still have all the services intact, that, I felt pretty good about that.
Mm.
The lowlights, or the exciting parts, is the floods. And the last one is really probably what led me to retire when I did. I was first of all, being city manager of a small town, especially your hometown, is about as good as it gets.
Yeah, yeah.
And you never have the same day twice, you know, which is the good thing about going to work. You know, there's always something new and challenging. Not always fun, but there's always something new and challenging. And so I loved it. But I really did, after a number of years, get to understand what Doug was talking about. The buck does stop there. You know, if you have to pass it on to the city council, you're not doing your job very well. And so it gets stressful. And you take abuse, but for the most part, I really did enjoy it. And then, when we had the New Year's Eve flood, 2006, I think it was, we opened the emergency command center at the public safety building, and I went down. And you know, 36 hours later, I'm still there, and I go, oh, I gotta call my son. I call up Dylan. I say, Dylan, I'm sorry. I can't go to the 49er game with you today. I'm really sorry. And he said, don't worry, Dad, I'm used to it.
Mm.
You know, that's kind of an aha moment.
Bingo. Yeah.
So it was time. It was time. You know, the kids were grown, but they'd given up a lot for me, and I was able to do a lot with them. I still coached them in Little League. I'd miss a game now and again, but but it was an aha moment. That and Bob Canepa's heart attack. Bob was one of the
Canepa.
It was a good friend in Rotary with me and worked in my market. And he had a heart attack, and he's 2 years older than me. And I started thinking about, am I going to work until I drop?
Wow.
So those two things kind of pushed me toward the end of my career. And looking back on it, I think it was right. I think it was I was getting to the point where my patience wasn't what it should have been.
Yeah, yeah. Speaking of your kids, let's go back now to family life.
Okay.
You come back to from Ferguson as you're married a year.
Married a year.
When do the kids come along?
Donovan, my oldest, came 9 years later.
9 years?
Yeah. We joke in the house. I bought my wife a lot of animals to delay the decision she had. We started with canaries and ended up with dogs. And, you know, if I waited any longer, I was going to have to buy her a horse. So, Susan dropped out of school to get married, so she went back to school when we came back.
Oh.
So we waited for her to do that, and we waited for her to work for a while, and then at that point, we also did some traveling, which we wanted to do before we had kids, because Lord knows when you have kids, you stop traveling.
That's right.
So... Yeah. It was 10 years after we got married that we had our first son, and then 3 years later our second. And that's Dylan. Donovan and Dylan. I wasn't a child of the 70s.
So what are they doing now?
Donovan is an attorney in San Francisco, and he's just given me my first grandson, Connor Roy.
Congratulations.
And Dylan works for MGA Healthcare, recruiting and placing nurses.
Oh, great.
And so they're both gainfully employed and off my payroll.
Are they both married?
Dylan has a live-in, but they're not married. And Donovan is married and has been for, going on 5 years.
Oh, great. Okay, so over the years, since you first moved to Mill Valley at the age of 3 until right now, what are some of the major changes you've seen in the town?
Well, you know the answer to this.
I have to say, I've read a lot of oral histories, and I know the answer, but I got to ask it.
Well, the easy answer is traffic. And also the composition of the community. Traffic, of course, like I mentioned earlier, we could have boat races on Blythedale when I lived on the corner of Blythedale and Delson. And you just, if you see a car, you'd step back, let it go by, and go back to racing your boats. I wouldn't. If I lived there now, I wouldn't let my kids outside. And I noticed, too, that, by the way, that house that I was in now has a fence around it the whole way, so the kids could probably play outside and be safe.
Oh, yeah.
It didn't used to. And that goes back to when we were kids, and I'm sure the same for you, there was one car in the household. Dad had the car. He took it to work. Mom walked, because we didn't have a second car until I was in junior high, maybe even my freshman year in high school. And the kids would ride bikes everywhere. You know, we played at Boyle Park constantly, and you'd just bike up there. And now, two cars in every house. It's a God-given right you get a car when you turn 16. Au pair, or nanny, pool guy, garden guy, house cleaner, and I don't know what percentage, but it always seems like a high percentage of houses are under construction. And we've seen the enemy, it's us. Look at the population numbers from 1960 to now. We're not that much bigger population-wise.
Yeah.
We're probably 5 times bigger vehicle-wise. It's just astounding. Mom and Dad would never think to say, you can't ride your bike on this street. You know, you went any place, and it was okay.
Yeah.
But the other thing was,
now everybody who lives in the house has a car.
Oh, yeah, unless they're underage. And theirs is in the garage waiting for them when they turn 60.
That's right.
But you also didn't need a car as much because all the services were local. You had gas stations that were gas stations and mechanics. You had an electrician and a plumber and all those people with offices locally. You had hardware stores. You had all of the things that you needed to run your life in Mill Valley. That's not the case anymore.
Right. I hear people complain they can't buy a spool of thread or a decent shirt.
That's probably true.
In Mill Valley.
That's probably true. Well, you can buy a shirt. You just have to mortgage your house to get it.
$200 shirt. Yeah.
Yeah. So it that has changed. Not only do the school teachers don't live here, they used to. The police don't live here, they used to. The firefighters, because of their shift schedules, they can be as far as, when I was still working, we had some in the foothills who would drive down because they could afford a nice house there. So that's changed too. And when that changes, then you know, you've got a commuting community because you've got to go someplace to get something. So those are the biggest things. And then, you know, I think that the fabric of the community changes when you're not seeing your teacher in the grocery store, when you're not talking to the guy who fixed your plumbing for you, when you're not... The Rianda Motors, which is my first job ever at 14 years old, I swept the floors down there on Miller Avenue. The head mechanic was two doors down from us. You know, those people don't live here anymore.
Yeah. I remember when... remember Jean Barnard?
Oh, yeah.
I remember when she was running for city council, like 40 years ago or so, 45. She used to say the biggest enemy to the future of Mill Valley was the automobile.
She was probably right.
Absolutely right.
Yeah. So those are the biggest changes. The other thing, and it's part and parcel of all of that, is we don't let our kids be kids. You know, when we were summer... And I was growing up in Mill Valley, the parade would start out in Alto, come by my place at Nelson, we'd all jump on our bikes, we'd keep going, and we'd have a baseball game by the time we got to Boyle Park. You know, and you're up there all day, you play all day. When the 5 o'clock whistle goes off, you know you got 10 minutes to get home or you're in trouble with mom. People don't entertain themselves like they have to be in an organized program. It has to be soccer, it has to be synchronized swimming, whatever. You know, kids aren't kids. We hike through the creeks. You know, we cut polywogs. We, all of the things. Kids don't do that now. It was a marvelous place to be a child. You had the mountain. You had creeks everywhere. You had hills to cardboard slide on.
Today the kids are all programmed.
Oh, of course they are. We used to get in trouble with ours because we'd make them call their friends and go play at the school. You know, they figured it out. It is fun. And they'd do the same things that we shouldn't have done when we were younger. They'd run around on the school roof down there. They'd go in the marsh and come back with stickers all over them from chasing polywogs. But those are the things that give you memories.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, let's see. What didn't we cover? You mentioned you had a sister. What's her name?
Her name is Gail.
And what does she do?
Gail works for PricewaterhouseCoopers. She's an office manager. She has had an interesting journey. She started out in recreation, like I did. As I should mention, I probably didn't, that the reason Susan and I met is because she was also in recreation, and she was in the recreation curriculum at San Jose State when I was, and I never met her there. I met her in San Diego. So at one point, very early in my career, if you wanted to do something recreationally in Southern Marin, you came through the Hunters, because Susan worked for Strawberry Recreation District. Susan worked for Corte Madera. My sister ran Strawberry Recreation District, and I was in Mill Valley.
Wow.
So for a while, we were all thinking, but Gail just, it never really clicked for her. So she retired at an early age.
Mm. She married?
Was.
Was married.
Was married. No kids. She retired at an early age and then went to work for Bank of America for a significant time, 10 years or so. And she retired again, took another break. So she's had a different life than me. She's gone through four different careers. And she loves what she's doing, but I think she's just about ready to retire. She's 2 years older than me.
Mm-hmm.
So it's fun having her close. I'm lucky that I have all the family close. We don't have Susan's brothers close, but everybody else is close.
Yeah. Where do you live now?
I live in San Rafael, in the Glenwood area.
Okay, let's see. What
What have we not covered?
I think we've just about done it.
Done career, family, kids, Mill Valley.
This morning, I got here a little early, and I walked through Old Mill Park. I haven't been down here for a few months, and Mill Valley's still a marvelous place. It really is magical. It's frustrating when you're sitting stuck in traffic, but when you get out of the car, this is still one of the most beautiful places in the world.
It really is. Last night I went to, Sunday night I went to the Rita Abrams show at the Throck.
Yeah, I read about that in the paper.
And it was all about what a fabulous place Mill Valley is, because of the song, of course. Mm-hmm. The song she wrote, Mill Valley.
Yeah, yeah. That came out when I was in Missouri.
And really?
Heard it on the radio there.
Is that right?
Yeah.
She still gets letters from all over the world.
I'm sure.
45 years later.
I guess 2 years ago, she finally had to move out of Mill Valley.
Yeah, she got priced out.
That's sad.
She's in Corte Madera now.
Yeah.
Well, okay. I can't think of anything else unless you can.
No, I think that's it. Thank you.
So thank you for doing this. Thank you for your service to Mill Valley. A lot of people think you were the best city manager we've ever had, including me. And so that's about it. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Ed. Mm-hmm.